Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong. It's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Good morning, Internet world, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert. We're here speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. So glad that you took some time out of your busy schedule this morning to join me. I apologize for us being an hour later than usual. Had some technical difficulties, some ghosts in the machine, as we say. And so what I did is I just reestablished the program, and we're joining you an hour later because it's so important about all the information I have to share with you. So very glad that you made some time for me today. Thank you so much. Today is Monday, March 2nd, 18 days to the official start of spring. And yet, most of us, myself included, are still a little bit snowbound, still a little bit under the deep freeze curse. Might I also add that 18 days from now is the beginning of the Nowruz celebration, the Persian New Year, and looking forward to really, really talking to my Iranian friends, finding out what they want to do for this new year, and praying most of all, praying fervently for a free Iran for them. Every year they have wishes. The number one wish they share with me is, please pray for our freedom. It's a constant refrain because they're very, very desperate. And every year they have a little bit more hope that something good is going to happen. Well, we serve a mighty good God, and I know He has their best interests in mind. And so please join me in praying for a free Iran. Please join me in wishing the best for my Iranian friends as they live under the oppression of a very fiercely dominating and controlling dictatorship in Iran. Well, I have some really good news I want to share with you this morning. I just talked to my dear Iranian friend, Mayor Noosh. In fact, it was 5:30 a.m. my time, and I get this phone call on Viber, and I look at the name, and it's Mayor Noosh, and I thought, well, and then it dawned on me. She had mentioned to me last week, Randy, please pray. I'm going to the immigration board next week, and they're going to tell me. And it was really, really good news. Mayor Noosh is a dear friend. She lives in Sweden. In fact, her story is in my latest book, The Cross in the Desert. And she has been just going through an intense, stressful time every day, wanting to hear news from the immigration board. Her lawyer had shared with her from the very beginning, and this was about, oh, I guess a year or so ago, Mayor Noosh, this looks very positive. But you know how we are. We know that Sweden has deported Iranians before. We know there are circumstances that come up, and so I kept encouraging Mayor Noosh. I said, Mayor Noosh, we're going to pray for you. I've got many friends. We're all going to pray together for you. I really believe that God has His hand in this immigration case. I really believe everything's going to look good. And she was ecstatic on the phone. She said, oh, Randy, I just wanted to share with you. You know, I went to the immigration board today, and I'm going to get to stay. She is official. This is really, really good news, because for her to have to go back to Iran would have been devastating for two reasons. Her ex-husband's there. He's very, very abusive. And number two, being a Christian, going back to Iran is lethal. It's dangerous. So I want to thank every one of you that pray for my Iranian friends. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for remembering them, because to be able to share with you this good news is so exciting for me. But I also want to mention there are many, many more refugees that need your prayers, that are desperate, just like Mehrnush was. Well, Mehrnush is going to be there with her family. Her whole family is there. And I don't know what all the criteria is in their decision-making, but I'm sure she had a positive case. The fact that her family was living there, everything was peaceful and good, I think all of this had a factor in Mehrnush's decision for residency. It's just great news I want to share with you. That's not the only good news. This was a very, very exciting past week and weekend for my wife, Becky, who flew to Washington, D.C. for her very first only CPAC convention. Well, that's where all of the potential candidates for 2016 gather. All of the journalists and the media was there. And Becky had an incredible time. She probably has more stories she hasn't told me yet, but she had an opportunity to meet Sean Hannity from Fox News. That was thrilling. She also met Colonel Alan West. He is the former House of Representatives congressman from Florida. She had a chance to meet him and also got close enough to Donald Trump. He is surrounded by security, so she couldn't get real close to him. And they're very particular who gets close to Donald Trump, I'm sure. In fact, I heard some stories that these are all former NYPD police officers who are being paid extremely well now, I'm sure, to guard Donald Trump. But that's not all. My wife got the wonderful opportunity to meet Naghma Abedini, which is the wife of Saeed Abedini, who, of course, you know, is in prison in Iran. And she had an opportunity to have her picture taken with her, to chat with her, to give her a copy of my book. But that's not all. Becky wants to write about Saeed, and she's going to write it on News Ninja. News Ninja is the website. It's a political conservative website with stories, with blogs, with radio programs. It's called NewsNinja.com or Live 365 War Radio, W-A-A-R, War Radio. As a matter of fact, the founder, Wayne Dupree, was honored this past weekend, receiving an award for the Blogger of the Year. So congratulations to my Facebook friend and to the founder of War Radio, News Ninja 2012, Wayne Dupree. And thank you so much, Wayne, for informing us and keeping us abreast of all the political happenings. And thank you so much for your service to the political arena of thoughts and ideas and putting out the conservative thought out there. We need that so much in what we are facing every day as we look at liberalism trying to wrap their ideas around our brains. We thank God for War Radio and News Ninja 2012 for putting the truth out there, the conservative truth that needs to be heard. And there's a lot of traffic on War Radio and on News Ninja. And congratulations, Wayne, for a very, very successful political talk radio website, War Radio, News Ninja, 2012.com. Well, my wife had a fantastic time, and she's finally back home. And reality, you know, kind of sucks as we have to get back to the normal life, but she has a lot of positive things to share about what went on there. And one of those things, as I mentioned, was meeting Naghma. Well, Naghma was the featured speaker, one of the featured speakers on the last day of CPAC. In fact, it was like 11 o'clock that morning, and she took the main stage. And, of course, we're going to feature what Naghma Abedini had to share at CPAC. We're going to listen to it right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Good morning. As some of you might know, my husband, Pastor Saeed Abedini, is an American pastor who's imprisoned in Iran because of his Christian faith. He's been tortured and beaten and told to denounce his Christian faith and return to Islam, but he stood strong in his faith and proclaimed Jesus as his Lord and Savior. He has endured beatings, solitary confinements, And he has refused to deny Christ. He stood up for his faith because he believes that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that he came on this earth and died on the cross to pay for his sin. When he learned that truth as a Muslim and learned the love of God, discovered the love of God for him, that transformed his life forever. And he wanted to lay down his life for the orphans and for those, for the helpless. My question is, as I am proud to see my husband stand up for his faith despite the evil and the just in the face of evil, my question is, as he's standing up for his faith, how are we standing up as a country for him, as his country for him? I am heartbroken that we continue to negotiate with Iran while he's holding one of our own, an American pastor. They're holding an American pastor captive. They're beating him. They're abusing him. And we refuse to secure his release. It's been over 2.5 years. And my question is, what kind of a message are we sending to the world when we continue to negotiate while Iran continues to abuse our one of our own, an American pastor? What message are we sending to the world about where we stand on religious freedom issues? You know, we know that silence in the face of evil, it's evil in itself. That means that when we don't act, when we don't speak, we are doing the same things that the prosecutors are doing to my husband. The persecutors are doing the same things, the beatings. We're doing the same things that we're seeing on TV, the beheadings of the Christians. When we don't speak, we're doing the same action when we don't speak in the face of evil, we're doing that evil ourselves. And so that has been frustrating over the last 2.5 years to know that my husband is being tortured and beaten as he stands strong in his faith and that we have yet to secure his release. It's been a very difficult 2.5 years for the kids and I. I found myself being a single mom. Something I always say is that I'm proud to be an American because America gave me the choice to choose Jesus. And I hope and I pray that that's something we can continue to have. Religious freedom is a core value that I believe that we've steered away from. I believe the world is watching. Saeed is a great example of he's become a face to Christian persecution. And I believe the world is watching on where we stand on religious freedom issues. And there's been a lot of silence. And I do believe that we need to get back to our core value of religious freedom and fighting for that and speaking out about that. If we don't address injustices, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So if we don't address what's going on across the world with the Christian persecution, it will be something we have to deal with here. And as we're seeing, that we're losing our religious freedom even in this country. And my husband is a great chance for our country to stand up and say, this is where we stand on religious freedom issues. I want to finish with this, something that's dear to my heart, and I know my husband's heart, that he's prayed for this great country for revival for many years. It's something I would find him weeping about and getting on his knees for hours praying for this country. You know, the Bible says that when we turn our eyes to God, when we repent and seek God, he will heal our land. The responsibility is on God to heal our land. Our responsibility is to seek him. And this great nation is blessed because of our foundation in Jesus Christ. My prayer is that I know that has been Saeed's prayer, and as he stood strong for his Christian faith, is that we would turn our eyes back on Jesus, that we would repent of the ways we've looked at to other things to fulfill us, and turn back our eyes back to Jesus, and pray and cry out for a nation to be for healing for our nation, and that we get back to our core value of religious freedom. So I want to ask you to partner with me and my family as we stand up for this important issue of religious freedom across the globe and ask and demanding that our country speaks out for Saeed. These are crucial times as Iran and U.S. are negotiating, and yet the issue of human rights and Saeed's imprisonment is not being addressed. I ask you to join me to bring Saeed's case up to your elected officials, continue writing letters and emails and calls, educate yourself about religious persecution, which we're seeing more and more across the world, pray for the persecuted, and continue to speak out. It's time to bring our American pastor home. It's time to speak out. It's time to... he's been there long enough. He's suffered for 2.5 years in the hands of radicals because of his Christian faith. It's time that we speak out and we speak up and say this cannot continue. While we're speaking with Iran, Iran needs to know where we stand on religious freedom issues, and we need to bring Saeed home. Thank you for your support. God bless you.
Nagma Abedini speaking on Saturday, this past Saturday at the CPAC convention. Every time I hear her, I am just so enamored and just awestruck at her amazing faith, amazing patience, and endurance. It's so easy to not think of that sometimes. We get so preoccupied with our own things in our life that we sometimes forget. Nagma has been waiting 2.5 years for her husband. Can't imagine what it's like to be a single mom, to be a single parent, and to be under the financial, the emotional strain, and then just your heart breaks that your husband hasn't been home for over 2.5 years. And anyone that knows the story of Saeed knows that he went to Iran in June of 2012 to continue work on the orphanage there. It was a government-approved orphanage. And yet, in July of that same year, the Revolutionary Guard descended upon him, and that's been the story of Nagma's life for the last 2.5, going on 3 years as we head towards the spring. She is an amazing woman. She's very busy all the time speaking for her husband, speaking for religious freedom. And she had previously been to a couple of other events there in Washington we're going to talk about in a minute. But this is a lady that is very committed as a Christian, very committed for the truth, very committed to speak out for religious freedom and to speak out for her husband, Saeed, and of course, also not forgetting Amir Hikmati and others in Iran that are suffering as well. But I just hope that you will continue to have Nagma in your prayers as she continues her crusade and fighting for religious freedom, fighting to bring Saeed back home. She mentioned the fight, and just about a month ago, President Obama met with Nagma and said to Nagma that Saeed is my top priority. And little Jacob, her son, spoke up to the president and said, "Can you please bring my daddy home by my birthday?" And President Obama leaned over and said, "When is your birthday, Jacob?" And Jacob mentioned March 17th. So time is running down. It's already the 2nd of March, but we are laboring in prayer, standing up for the soon return of Saeed. Now, I mentioned earlier that Nagma was also busy with some other events in Washington. I want you to hear this special report from CBN as we travel with Nagma on this very busy weekend in Washington, right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
CBN News viewers have been praying for Pastor Saeed Abedini, an American imprisoned for his faith in Iran. Saeed's father was able to visit him this week, and the two were also able to pray together. Here at home, Saeed's wife, Nagma, is in our nation's capital this weekend to raise awareness and appeal to government leaders to continue working for her husband's release. Joining us now by Skype is Nagma Abedini. Great to have you back on the broadcast, Nagma. This morning, you had a chance to meet with Rabbi David Saperstein, the U.S. Ambassador for Religious Freedom. What did you ask of him, and how did you respond?
Well, thank you for having me back. And it was a great meeting with the ambassador, and they have wanted my family and I to know that Saeed is a high priority, and the religious freedom issue aspect of it is very important to our government. And the meeting was to discuss ways and efforts on getting Saeed out of the Iranian prison and back to the U.S. soil, and the And the reason he's there is because of his conversion, because he's a Christian. And my emphasis was that's an important message for us to send out as the United States of America, that this is an important issue in getting this Christian pastor out, especially now in the world where Christians are under intense persecution.
Nagmeh, I understand that millions of Iranian Muslims had a chance to watch your interview with Voice of America Persia. What are you hoping this will accomplish? Because your message is going directly into the Islamic Republic.
It was a great interview with Voice of America Persia. My heart was to tell the Iranian people that, like me, they might not have any connections with anyone, but they can have a connection with God. I prayed. I had no connection, no way of getting to meet with the president, and I prayed and I sought God, and he made the meeting happen, and I told President Obama that, and I shared that with the Iranian people, that they might not know anyone and the situation in their life might seem very hard and uncontrollable, something they can't control, be it economic pressures, finances, someone in prison, or going through the trials of life, but I was able to share that they can always get on their knees and pray to God, and that as a Christian, we have that access. When you accept Christ as your Lord and Savior, you have that direct access to God, and He's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And I got to share about that and the power of prayer and going to God with all of your problems. And it was great knowing that millions of Iranians get to listen.
As I mentioned to our audience, you are in our nation's capital. The Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, offered you a spot in their conference tomorrow. What will you tell them?
You know, I want to share Christ. I have every opportunity I have. I will be in the front of the main audience at the main auditorium speaking. And I want to share about Saeed and religious freedom issue, but at the same time that there's hope and that God is getting Saeed through all the beatings and torture, his faith in Jesus Christ, and that our faith, my faith in Jesus Christ, is what's really getting me through, and it's something I've discovered, the deeper walk and intimacy with Christ. And I want to encourage those who are listening, the audience, to if they don't know Christ, to accept them as their Lord and Savior, and if they do, to pursue a deeper walk with Him, deeper relations, deeper intimacy with Him of who He is, and getting to really abide, get into a deeper intimacy with Christ, and to know Him and to walk with Him.
Many of our viewers here in the U.S. and around the world know that you had a chance to meet with President Obama last month. After that meeting and the meeting you had with the Religious Freedom Ambassador, do you think that progress is being made in freeing your husband? Do you feel hope rise, or what are your feelings like today?
You know, from before the meeting with the president to after, I've definitely seen a change in the tone and in how the White House and State Department are their communication with me, and the priority that has been placed on this issue. I don't accept that God has brought this to the forefront and is moving in hearts. I don't know how to explain this shift, but I do believe there's been. I don't know what that means in terms of getting Saeed home sooner. I'm praying that this will be the year he's home, but I do see a change in heart, and we had a great meeting with the White House staff and the State Department staff with the ambassador. Many people were in that room, and they got, you know, we got to share Christ, and I see a lot of hearts being touched in State Department and the White House through Saeed's story, and I'm thankful for that. And I do hope that because their hearts are being touched, the ambassador's heart was deeply touched. He said that as a Jewish rabbi, that he prays often for Saeed. There's a prayer of blessing that they do, and for the last year, he's prayed, every time he's prayed that prayer, he's brought up Saeed's name. So I could see that his heart was moved, and I know that God can use that to bring Saeed home. Maybe he can call, he has a connection that can get Saeed home.
You recently, Nagmeh, shared a remarkable testimony of Saeed and his father praying and worshiping the Lord in prison. Tell us that story. How did it happen, and what was the result?
Well, usually Saeed has a 20-minute, very watched by guards, a very short meeting, 20 minutes every week with his father behind a glass window. And this time we got to visit, and they just start praying and worshiping God and just focusing They usually chit-chat, and Saeed wants updates on what's going on and the kids and so on. But this time they really focus on just praying and worshiping God in the midst of this horrible circumstance. And the 20 minutes got done, and the guards were just in awe. There was, as I heard, there was just such a strong presence of the Lord in that room that the 20 minutes changed to 40 minutes. They actually met over for over 2 hours. All the other visitors left and prisoners left, and it just seemed to be this bubble of time where it was Saeed and his father, and the guards were not stopping the meeting, and they were letting them just pray and worship Jesus at that prison. And that for me was just an amazing testimony. I know those guards' hearts, and even others who'd come and gone visiting their prisoners, they were moved by the presence of the Lord in that prison.
How's he doing physically? Is he still in danger from Islamic militants in the prison?
They have isolated him. He's the only Christian in his cell. He continues. There's hardliners in prison with him, such as from the Mujahideen, which is a very radical sect of Islam. And there's just different groups of Muslims that are even in prison that are hardliners. Those who associate with ISIS have been removed from his cell. He still has some kind of a contact where they're in the same ward, and sometimes they come across each other's path in the yard. But he's continually put under pressure as the only Christian, as a convert, not just a Christian, but someone who's converted from Islam to Christianity. He's under constant threat and intimidation. But there's just so many stories of those who've intimidated him really seeing the love of God and changing their hearts and wanting to know the God that Saeed serves.
Nagmay, I know that you would probably say that your husband is a hero of the faith, but I know people around the world consider you equally a hero of the faith, the faith you have displayed over these many months, and continuing to stand for your husband to see his release has been very, very encouraging to millions of people around the world. And I want you to know that here at your CBN News family, we continue to pray not just for you, but for the release of your husband. So thank you so much for joining. As always, a tremendous pleasure to have you on the broadcast.
My strength comes from Jesus Christ. I'm a very weak person, but I appreciate all the prayers and support. I couldn't do it without it. Thank you.
Nicely said. Welcome. God bless you.
Special report with CBN with Nagmay Abedini this past weekend, talking about her amazing testimony of what happened between Saeed and his father in prison. This meeting went on for 4 hours. It's supposed to have only been 20 minutes, but it seems that God had other plans as they met and shared and worshiped and prayed together. And the guards themselves, I believe, were touched by that. God is doing amazing things in this dark and cruel prison, surrounded with militants and murderers and drug dealers. Saeed truly is a light in the darkness there. And we also heard that Nagmay had an appearance on Voice of Persian TV, and that was amazing too. That means the broadcast went right into the heart of Iran. So our God is able to do amazing things in our brokenness and in our weakness and in our willingness to stand for him. He does the rest in an amazing way. Well, as we've been sitting here listening to Nagmay, one of the stories in my book, The Cross in the Desert, is about her. It's called Embracing Your Trials. And very quickly, what I wanted to share with you is when Nagmay has been on my radio program, she talks about this concept of embracing our trials. Well, most of us want to run. It's painful. Whatever the trial may be, financial, physical, whatever it is, the concept of us embracing it is hard for us to comprehend. But here is a lady that has embraced this trial, and God has brought beauty out of the ashes of her suffering. And James writes, when trouble comes your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. For when you know that your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. James chapter 1, verses 2 through 3. So what Nagmay is advocating is very biblical. Don't run from your trials. Embrace them with great joy. Your faith is being tested. You're being molded and shaped. And yes, it's painful, but God is accomplishing a great purpose through it. The world sees your steadfastness. The non-Christian sees your steadfastness in the midst of a trial. That itself is a witness and a testimony. Well, many things are happening in the news. We're going to talk about the upcoming meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu and Congress. In fact, that's just tomorrow. But there are a lot of things coming to light coming out and being exposed about Iran's connection with al-Qaeda. I want you to hear this very special report on Fox News that documents Iran's connection with al-Qaeda. Let's listen right now in The Cross in the Desert.
I'm Martha McCallum.
And I'm Bill Hemmer. Good morning. A bombshell report from the Weekly Standard claiming the White House has been ignoring direct proof of Iran's link to al-Qaeda and explaining why it is so concerned about Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech on Tuesday before Congress.
The link between Iran and al-Qaeda, discovered in a treasure trove of bin Laden documents that the administration has been sitting on for years, all as the White House seeks a nuclear deal with Iran. Steve Hayes is senior writer for the Weekly Standard. He wrote this exhaustive and fascinating piece. Steve, good to have you here this morning.
Thanks, Martha.
All right, so I've got a number of questions for you based on this. First of all, the president has made it very clear that he does not want Netanyahu to speak here, and they have said it's because of protocol issues and elections. You say not so. Why?
Well, look, I think if you look at the 6 years of history of the Obama administration in Iran, it's been very clear, really from the outset, that they wanted this rapprochement with Iran, that they wanted to sort of extend a hand, that they were seeking some kind of a deal, that they wanted to extend warm relations to Iran, and nothing was going to get in their way. And I think we've seen over the course of the administration, whether it's in some cases the administration's own designations of al-Qaeda figures who were working in Iran, whether it's the administration's own designations of Iranian ministries that were aiding and abetting al-Qaeda figures working in Iran, that the president just hasn't wanted to talk about that much. You had the bureaucrats sort of doing the bureaucratic spade work, but the rest of the administration unwilling to talk about it.
All right, so we talked about the fact that there were 10,000 documents that were uncovered during the bin Laden raid, and that was considered a big feather in the cap of the administration. It was going to be this great treasure trove of intelligence. But you report that only 10% of those documents were ever investigated, and then somebody there was told to stop digging. Really?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, the number is more than a million documents, depending on how you count them. More than a million documents that were recovered in this raid that killed Osama bin Laden. Basically, there was an initial scrub that the CIA conducted that lasted several weeks. And by all accounts, it was very productive. James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, said that initial scrub produced 400 intelligence reports, which led to U.S. action around the globe targeting al-Qaeda. So that initial scrub was great. But then it all stopped. The CIA basically sat on the documents. They retained what's called executive authority. Well, I think it's because they didn't want to know what was in them. The Obama administration didn't want to know what was in them. And you know, these documents have tremendous implications, not only for our policy with respect to Iran, but for potentially our policy as it relates to our own allies. So what were the Brits doing in Afghanistan? What about Pakistani intelligence? How much of an overlap was there between Pakistani intelligence and senior al-Qaeda leadership? It requires, once you expose these documents in al-Qaeda's own hand, it requires the administration to act on them. And the president's argument all along has been that the war on terror is ending.
Is over. All right. You know, in terms of Iran, the president has had what some would characterize as a cozy relationship with the supreme leader of Iran. Now, if they have a cozy relationship with al-Qaeda, that is something that he is not going to want to discuss, because al-Qaeda is our clear enemy. And he wants to make a deal with Iran, and he seems to think that he's, you know, seeing into the soul of this supreme leader to some extent, no?
Right. I mean, the president has made clear from the very beginning of his administration that he wanted to, quote, decouple the nuclear talks with Iran on the one hand from all other regime activity. So that's why he sort of turned a blind eye toward the repression in Iran in the June 2009 elections after the mullahs fixed the elections. It's one of the reasons we haven't heard any real discussion of Iran and terrorism in any kind of a consistent way from the administration, in spite of the fact, I think it's really important to point out, the Treasury Department, when it's doing these designations, is making a clear and consistent and unequivocal case that there exists a secret relationship between Iran on the one hand and al-Qaeda. So you have bureaucrats in the Obama administration being very clear about that relationship and what it portends for the West.
Yeah, and no doubt Benjamin Netanyahu will want to spill all of this when he speaks in front of Congress, and that's quite uncomfortable for the administration at this point. We got to leave it there, but Steve, I encourage everybody to read your piece in the Weekly Standard this week if they really want to.
It's an amazing story, what is going on behind the scenes. As we listen to this report, it should send chills up your spine. Appeasement, coziness, these are two buzzwords that seems to fit the Obama administration agenda. Appeasement, we're not going to confront, we're not going to demand human rights. Instead, we're going to talk about nuclear rights and be cozy with a terrorist nation that also has links into Hezbollah, of course, and then helping Assad in Syria. It is a bloodthirsty dictatorship. It is a terrorist regime. And the amazing thing is the very man that we need to hear the confrontation from is being appeasement and being cozy. And so we should welcome someone like a Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, to come and beg us and plead us not to be so naive as to sit down with Iran. And what do? We don't talk with him. And most of the Democrats want to boycott the meeting. What has happened to the guts, the confrontation, the standards of a nation that we used to stand for? As Nagme was talking about, religious freedom, our principles. What has happened to us that we would turn a deaf ear to a voice that's crying out not to sit down with Iran? Have we forgotten our history? Have we forgotten when the time that Neville Chamberlain said all is well with the Munich Pact and the next year Germany invaded Poland? We have lost our bearings, our moorings, our convictions, our leadership. It is too comfortable, too appeasing, too cozy. And now we face a very serious situation. And so tomorrow is a very important day. I am praying for congressmen to listen intently to what Benjamin Netanyahu has to say. He is a man of purpose and courage and conviction, and he has a message. I'm going to play now an important report about Israel feeling that it's their sacred duty to come and visit us. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
That Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it is his sacred duty to speak to a joint session of Congress about the dangers of a bad deal with Iran. Netanyahu spoke to the American Jewish leaders meeting in Jerusalem Monday, and he called Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons, quote, the most urgent security concern facing the world. The U.S. and other international players are negotiating with Iran over its nuclear program. Netanyahu has been at odds with the White House and the Israeli left wing for weeks over the invitation to address the U.S. Congress. His opponents charge the speech is politically motivated because it comes just 2 weeks before Israeli general elections. But Netanyahu responded to the criticism with three questions, saying the very survival of his country is at stake.
Why Congress? Why Washington? Why now? Because of the grave dangers posed by the deal that is on the table right now. I don't see this issue in partisan terms. The survival of Israel is not a partisan issue. It concerns everyone.
Netanyahu is set to speak to Congress on March 3rd.
Welcome back. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to address a joint meeting of Congress next week, putting a spotlight on Iran's nuclear program. Iran's top nuclear negotiator accusing Mr. Netanyahu of fear-mongering, saying the speech won't stop a final nuclear deal between the West and Iran. Lisa Daftari is a Mideast journalist and Fox News contributor. She joins us now with a perspective on this very dicey yet touchy issue between the White House, the U.S. Congress, and the Israeli leader, Sir Benjamin Netanyahu. What do you think his message will be when he addresses Congress?
Right. So obviously, Bibi Netanyahu feels, correctly so, that Iran becoming the nuclear power will be an existential threat to Israel. Now, the question is, do we actually need Bibi Netanyahu to come in to Congress to tell us that the Iran deal is a bad deal? No. We already have bipartisan support, meaning lawmakers in this country already are expressing fear that this is a bad idea. Sanctions are what brought Iran to the negotiating table, and pressure, economic and otherwise, is what will keep Iran at the negotiating table. But we have an administration that wants to strike any type of deal with Iran, and in the process has marginalized not only Bibi Netanyahu, but other powers in the region, including Saudi Arabia and Egypt, who think it's a bad idea to allow Iran to do this. He's marginalized lawmakers on both sides, including Democrats, and more importantly, he's really marginalized the Iranian people. Now, look, the biggest threat to the Iranian regime is not the P5 plus one. It's not Israel. It's not any of these countries that are putting its feet to the fire. It's really the 75 million Iranians at home. And in 2009, they came to the streets and they said, help us. Help us remove this regime. And that's what I think is the biggest foreign policy blunder that the Obama administration is responsible
because
for.
Because no one responded to that.
Well, they needed foreign support. I mean, we look back at 1979 and President Carter, he was integral in helping put support behind the ousting of the Shah and bringing Khomeini to power. And now we would have had the same opportunity to really remove the mullahs from Iran and give them a chance. That was the real, although it's not an Arab country, that was the real start of an Arab Spring, the Iranian people telling the world what they wanted.
So what do you make of the speech that Prime Minister Netanyahu will make? And is, I mean, it's too late to turn that around now. And what do you make of the fact that the White House is not even entertaining him when he arrives here?
Right. This is not the first time that the White House has snubbed Bibi Netanyahu. It's been a long time coming. Obviously, this is a climax because it's in front of the world stage. But, you know, Israel will be and has been and will be our biggest ally, our strongest supporter and an ally and friend in the region, and particularly now when we see the world is really being swallowed up by this radicalism, and we can separate the Sunnis and the Shiites and ISIS and the Iranian regime. They're all on the same list because they all have the same goal. There's a one-to-one correlation between when Israel is safe, secure, and thriving, that will mean the same thing for the region and the same thing for national security for the U.S.
Well, let me ask you then on that point, is Mr. Netanyahu actually going to be inducing fear, or is he actually going to giving us a wake-up call?
No, he's going to give his case, and that is going to be that Iran having a nuclear deal will be a bad deal for everyone. The region, and we can go from micro to macro. What would a good deal with Iran be? Bibi Netanyahu, the region, everyone would be on board with a good deal with Iran, and that would mean from small to large, changes back at home, behavioral changes, stopping of the executions. I mean, human rights abuses that are, right, including four Americans that are not being demanded back as a part of this deal. We're talking about their tentacles in the region, their hand in Syria, supporting of Hezbollah, supporting of Hamas, and then going all the way back to their nuclear deal, the way that they're still exporting terrorism. None of this behavior has changed. They're not complying with the IAEA, and yet we are changing our behavior vis-a-vis Iran in order to push this deal through. And Bibi Netanyahu will make a very cogent argument against this deal, the same way that we've seen lawmakers, again, on both sides of the political aisle make the same very strong case.
Lisa Zatari, thank you for sharing your insights on this.
Absolutely.
And perspective on it. Obviously, we will see this in living color next week.
Yeah, it should
and it
be.
Should be quite an event. All right, thank you very much.
Of course.
Julie?
All right, Lisa Deftari, she's the on-air talent. She's amazing. She has such a strong connection with the Middle East. She's Iranian Jewish. She knows about Iran. She knows about the Middle East. She's a strong supporter of Israel. An amazing woman who has a lot of insight of counterterrorism. And hopefully sometime this year, when her schedule is not so busy, and we will have Lisa Deftari as a special guest here on The Cross in the Desert. But she is incredible. Her insights, her hard work, and she is a busy lady as well, trying to keep track of everything that's happening in the world. I am looking forward to this speech tomorrow. We'll have a special segment on the Thursday edition of The Cross in the Desert, and we will go over the things that Benjamin Netanyahu shared with Congress. And if you think about the history of Iran since the revolution, Iranians protested against the so-called human rights abuses of the Shah. Millions flocked around Khomeini, who promised all this democratic freedom. And of course, you know the result when he took power, how most of the Shah's military supporters were executed. Women came to the street and said, we are not going to wear this hijab. So whatever Khomeini had shared beforehand in media events about women having rights was a bold-faced lie. And then as we see Khomeini seizing power in Iran, we see how they took over American hostages at the embassy. We have seen how they have exported Islam to the world. Khomeini made this declaration that that's what he was going to do. And so we see how terrorism took root February 1979. And then what happened 4 years later, Beirut, and our Marines were killed in a terrorist bombing, supposedly by Hezbollah. And then we've seen the rise of Hamas and Hezbollah working together. We've seen atrocities all over the world, especially now in Syria. Then the rise of ISIS. In view of everything that I've said to you, can you imagine for a second that any world leader would sit down with the number one sponsor of terrorism, sit down and negotiate, comprehend that? I cannot comprehend that. Number one, release our Americans. Release Saeed. Release Amir. Number two, clean up the abuse against your own people, demanding an end to the executions and the civil and human rights abuses in Iran. And instead, the word comes back to haunt us. Appeasement. Coziness. Lord, help us. What has happened to our convictions? Please pray for this nation that we once again have a strong leadership with convictions, and we stand against terrorism, and we stand against human rights violations, and we demand the release of the Americans held hostage in Iran. This should be the number one precondition. Why are we sitting down at the table and behaving this way? It is an atrocity. It's unreal. Well, what I want to do now is play a short clip. This is an author, he's a co-author, in fact, Michael Weiss, that has written a very insightful book called ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror. We've seen what they have done to Christians, what they have done to Yazidis and Iraqis, what they've done to many Muslims. They are a terrorist. And this is an interesting little feature I want to play for you right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
That there absolutely is an Islamic component to this, and you have true believers. I mean, on the middle and lower cadres of this organization are absolutely outfitted with guys. All these guys coming over from the West and the Middle East and North Africa, I mean, they want to do jihad. They are fired up Muslims. But again, I think it pays to scrutinize who's actually running the show here.
Mike Barnacle.
Michael, what would be the most primary goal of ISIS? Would it be the establishment of this caliphate that they want to establish, or would it be to actively engage the United States military on the ground again in the Middle East?
Well, Zarqawi famously laid a trap for the United States. Both he and Osama bin Laden, although the two didn't get on very well at all, they anticipated the U.S. war. And Zarqawi's goal was essentially to bleed America into its departure. But fundamentally, actually, his number one target in Iraq were the Shia. This was a genocidal maniac. He thought, look, okay, the Shia are the majority here, the Sunnis are the minority, but if we go off and we behead the Shia, blow up their shrines and their mosques, it will prompt an over-retaliation on their part, or sectarian bloodletting in reverse, which will then drive the Sunnis into our fold and also attract the Mujahideen from around the world. Well, guess what? The U.S. strategy as of now, essentially a de facto partnership with Iran, we're flying warplanes overhead, bombing ISIS locations as these Shia militia groups go in and then clear ISIS out of villages and hamlets. That is playing exactly into the Zarqawist plan. I don't think they necessarily want to engage U.S. forces, but fighting Shia militia groups, that's great. That goes right into their apocalyptic mission.
And
that is co-author Michael Weiss of a book called ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror. And he has some tremendous insights into what motivates them. And, of course, they want to establish a caliphate, that is an Islamic government. And it is religiously motivated. When you see the way that they use the Quran in beheading individuals, the 21 Coptic Christians, the world is watching a terrorist, radical Islam, take over the Middle East. This is frightening. And in fact, it's amazing to me how structured they are. Propaganda, they are able to influence people. And I had an opportunity last night when I was at work. I didn't come across this article until actually last night about a man accused of providing money and weapons to ISIS. He was arrested in Plainfield. That's in Indiana, I think. Well, this is 26-year-old Nahid Rasik of Utica, New York. He was part of a group of six Bosnians accused of helping ISIS. He was charged with funneling money and weapons to ISIS in the Middle East, as well as conspiring to kill and maim persons in a foreign country. Now, the thing that's frightening about this is the warrant for his arrest was issued right out of St. Louis, where I live. And he was, of course, apprehended, thankfully, and in Marion County Jail from February 6th to the 11th. This is frightening. This kind of activity, these kind of sympathizers, these people that are working hand-in-hand with ISIS, seemingly are all around us. And yours truly, in his backyard, my backyard. And it's frightening to think that this activity is going on, that ISIS has this much influence with even those who live near you. Now, this is not to foster paranoia to anyone, but we have to be discerning. We have to be vigilant and always keep on our guard, because they could be living next door to us. It really, really is frightening. When I read this story, I thought, wow, I'm very glad they apprehended him, thankfully. Just about a year ago, I had a very special guest on my Cross in the Desert. His name was Nabil Qureshi, author of the book Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, a very intelligent man who has gone from Islam to Christianity, from Muhammad to Jesus, and he has really revolutionized the world with his message of hope and his message of love. Well, God is really working in the heart of Muslims all over the world through dreams, through visions. And Nabil is no exception to that. But I want you to hear his testimony once again. It's been a year since he's been on, but this is a special feature of Nabil Qureshi and why he questioned his Muslim faith. A special CBN report right now on the Cross in the Desert.
It was really something I had to wrestle with, because at this point, all the talk about Islam being a religion of peace was being confronted with a very vivid visual picture of people being murdered in the name of Allah.
Since childhood, Nabil Qureshi had been a devout Muslim. He was raised in a loving family from a peaceful sect of Islam.
The slogan for the sect is love for all, hatred for none. And so growing up, I was taught to love everyone.
Nabil pursued his faith with rigor. He prayed five times a day and memorized the Quran in English and Arabic. He was determined to prove that Islam was the only true faith, especially to Christians.
When I challenged them on the reliability of the Bible, or when I challenged them on the deity of Christ or the crucifixion, when I challenged them on the Trinity, they would have no answer, and they begin a very quick retreat into the realm of faith. I just believe on faith. And I'm thinking, well, you're using the word faith the way I use the word ignorance.
Then, in his freshman year of college, he saw another side of his faith.
I have to answer for myself, what is Islam really? Is it what I've been taught? Is it what these guys are proclaiming? And of course, I was sure it was what I had been taught. It was peaceful. But then how do I explain what's happening on the TV?
He wrestled with those images and thoughts for months. Then later that year, he met David, a Christian. Like Nabil, he knew how to defend his faith through logic and reason.
David was able to give me reasons to believe in the Bible, reasons to believe that the Bible hasn't been changed, that it's the inspired word of God, that the canon of the Bible, the 66 books of the Bible, are actually what should be in the Bible, and no other book should be in that collection. He had thought about these things.
Despite the differences, Nabil and David became friends, and over the next 3 years, often debated about religion. Nabil held on to his beliefs, but was running out of arguments.
Whenever I started providing reasons to him, that's when he started pointing things out, flaws in my reasoning.
It became even clearer when he compared the Bible to the Quran and looked closely at the teachings of Muhammad.
It became abundantly clear why people could be so violent in their practice of Islam, because the original teachings of Muhammad, there were some very, very violent teachings found in the traditions of Islam. I'm trying to defend Islam, you know, to my friend who is a Christian. I'm trying to explain to him why Islam is peaceful, why women are given equal rights, all these things that I truly believe now I have to defend. And I'm failing miserably because there just was no defense.
Nabil saw the only logical conclusion was that Jesus is the Son of God. But admitting that went against everything he had ever believed in.
The biggest blasphemy in Islam is to worship anything other than Allah. If there is a chance that Islam could be false, that's a crisis. That's going to shake my world, and it did. And that's what drove me to my knees, and that's when I began to ask God, who are you?
In the Muslim tradition, Nabil asked God to show him the truth through a dream. God gave him three. One in particular had a profound effect.
I was standing at the threshold of a narrow door. This door was just wide enough to fit me, just tall enough to fit me. It was the most poignant symbol in the dream, was just how narrow this door was. I could barely fit in it. And on the other side of this doorway was a room that had been set with a feast. I knew that that room was heaven. And I knew that I had to get into that room if I wanted to be in heaven.
Later, he read a passage in the Bible that confirmed his dreams. Convinced of the truth, his world was shattered. Seeking comfort, he reached for the Quran.
I pull out the Quran and I start going through its pages, and it was a rude awakening that there isn't a single verse in the Quran designed to comfort a hurting man. Not one. And so I put it away, I turned to the Bible, I went to Matthew, and it didn't take long for me to get to Matthew chapter 5, and here's what it says. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And so I'm saying to God, God, I know what you want me to do, but I just need time to mourn. I just need time to mourn. I just fell in love with the Bible at that moment. It was as if God had written those words specifically for me. He knew 2,000 years ago that I was going to need comfort in this moment, and he knew that I would go to Matthew, so he put that verse in Matthew for me. And I said, okay, this is real. This is the Word of God. This faith is where the truth is found. And that's when I ultimately, by reading the Bible, accepted Christ.
Nabil started telling people about his new faith, including his parents. He says they were disappointed, but still love their son. He is praying that they will one day accept Christ.
So they can know him. So that they can be with him for eternity. So we can all be together for eternity. I can't even imagine. Honestly, I can't even imagine going to church with my family. And I would love someday for my father and my mother to be worshiping alongside me. I can't even think about it because I'll just break up.
Today, he works for world-renowned apologist Ravi Zacharias and has a book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. He is most grateful for the understanding of truth and the gift of eternal life.
Jesus was able to resurrect from the dead. He has killed death, and this life is all about life. It doesn't end in death. And there's nothing, nothing more freeing than that.
The special report on CBN featuring Nabil Qureshi. Isn't that an incredible testimony? The Bible teaches us in 1 Peter 3:15, be ready always to give to everyone who asks you an answer for the hope that lies within you. This is a command. Every Christian has this given responsibility to answer the objections against the Christian faith, to give a reason for the hope that lies within us. And it's amazing to me that Nabil sadly said that when he would ask questions of most Christians, critical questions, who is Jesus? What about the resurrection? Everyone he asked, well, we just take it on faith, Nabil. What kind of a response defending the faith? That's not giving a reasonable answer for the hope that lies within you. But God prepared a certain man for Nabil who was willing to, first of all, love him where he's at, to be his friend, and then to answer those questions that were gnawing at Nabil's heart. You know what I like about Nabil's testimony is this friend in college, first of all, showed respect and friendship. He didn't just become his friend to evangelize him or to preach to him. That was the result of Nabil's question. But this friend, because he took the time, labored patiently, and answered his questions, God used this in a powerful way to bring Nabil to faith. And every Muslim faces a crisis. If they renounce Islam in many countries, they can be killed. They can lose their family. And sadly, that has happened with Nabil. His family is alienated from him because of his faith. And so my heart and prayers goes out to Nabil. I remember how powerful his testimony was here on the program a year ago. I will probably replay that again. But he is an intelligent, committed and passionate man who wants to reach Muslims with the good news of Christ in a respectable way, in a very strong way, a very apologetic way. There are reasons we can trust the Bible. There are reasons we can believe who Jesus claimed to be. There are reasons we believe in the resurrection. And Nabil got the answers to those questions. An amazing, amazing testimony. Well, it all happens at the cross, where Jesus paid for every sin, every shame, every guilt we've ever had. He paid for not only past, but present and future. He displayed his great love for us at the cross. And we're going to hear now from Chris Tomlin's new CD, Love Ran Red. Here's the song, At the Cross, on the cross in the desert.
A place where mercy reigns and never dies. There's a place where streams of grace flow deep and wide. Where all the love I've ever like a flood comes flowing down at the cross, at the cross. I surrender my life. I'm in all of you. I'm in all of you. Where your love ran red and my sin washed white. I owe to you, Jesus.
from his latest effort, his CD, Love Ran Red at the Cross. It's a song that addresses the issue of how one's shame and guilt is washed away and forgiven. You know, many of us live in a prison of shame. We are chained to guilt, and sometimes our life is suffocated by shame and guilt. And many people look for an escape or a solution or a quick fix to that. Some choose drugs and alcohol. Others become involved in the sex slave trade or human trafficking, looking for a way to feel good about ourselves. But actually, the sex slave trade and human trafficking is the very shame and guilt that many are trying to escape. They're looking for meaning and purpose. They're looking for a cure, a fix. And there are many people in the world, well-meaning people, sincere people, who are very religious, who look at their life as feeling pretty good about themselves. Got a nice job, got a nice income, got a nice home. And then they go to church every Sunday, and they stand with others in worship and thank God for all of the good things they have. And they look up to God and say, you know, what can I do today, God, that will please you? What can I do today that will earn my way to heaven when I die? What can I do that's good? I'll never forget about, I think it was 4 years ago, it's been a long time, how quickly time passes. I had a Muslim friend named Avian. At that time, she was a Muslim. In fact, she has left Islam and become a Wiccan. But at the time I knew her, she wanted me and my other friend to go to the mosque. She wanted to just show off her newfound faith. And, you know, I went along with her. And just because I'm trying to be a good friend to her and share with her. I'll never forget the whole time I was at the mosque, I heard about points and merit. Constantly, the imam there spoke about praying to Allah gains you so many points if you're here at the mosque for daily prayer or for weekly prayer on a Friday. If you're at home, that's okay too, but it's most important to be here in a group in worship at the mosque. It gains you lots of points and merit. And I constantly heard this term, points, merit. And of course, the average Muslim believes that through good works, obedience, points, merit, fasting, praying, giving, that this will get them into paradise. They hope they will. They're not sure, but they're hoping on the day of judgment when Allah evaluates their life, that this will be the reason why they will get there. They're under a lot of pressure to perform. Well, in the Bible, Jesus deals with this issue very straightforwardly. If you've ever read through the Gospel of Luke, you know there are many amazing parables there to teach us something very important. One of my favorite, of course, is the parable of the prodigal son. It shows the mercy and love of God for our waywardness. When people decide to go their own way, God runs after them with his irresistible love. In the case of the father, forgiving the prodigal son for what he did. Jesus taught that parable to emphasize a point. God's love and mercy is greater than our sin. He is forgiving. But what I want to share with you today is another parable in the Gospel of Luke that deals with this subject of how to get right with God. Muslims want to be right with Allah. Jesus comes along and says, there is a way to have a right relationship with God. And Luke writes, then Jesus told this story to some who had great confidence in their own righteousness and scorned everyone else. I want to read this to you, and then we're going to talk about it today. Jesus says, two men went to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, and the other was a despised tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed this prayer, quote, I thank you, God, I am not a sinner, like everyone else. For I don't cheat, I don't sin, and I don't commit adultery. I certainly am not like that tax collector. I fast twice a week, and I give you a tenth of my income. But the tax collector stood at a distance and dared not even lift his eyes to heaven as he prayed. Instead, he beat his chest in sorrow, saying, "Oh God, be merciful to me, for I am a sinner." Jesus says, "This sinner, not the Pharisee, returned home justified before God. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." I think the message is very clear here, but I want to amplify on it. I want you to hear what Jesus says about the Pharisee. What are his credentials? Well, first of all, he is a person of prayer, just like the publican or tax collector. The Pharisees loved to parade their spirituality in what they wore and in public praying. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus used the example of the Pharisees and how not to be like them when we prayed. He basically says, go to your Father in secret. Don't try to be an open display of praying to show off your spirituality. Now, that's not to say that public praying is wrong, but Jesus is getting at the motive. Pharisees love to show off their spirituality. They were the experts in the law, right? They had twisted and perverted God's law, but they were putting the teachings of their perversion as heavy loads on the disciples of Jesus. And that's why Jesus could say to his disciples, "Come to me, you who are weary and carry heavy loads, and I will give you rest. Jesus knew the pressure to conform to the Pharisees' interpretation of the law, how burdensome that was. But this Pharisee, as he prayed, made it very clear. He thanked God, first of all, that he was not a sinner. He had no conviction of sin. He was trusting in his own righteousness, his own merit. And then he began to outline what he did not do. "Look, Lord, I don't cheat. I don't sin, and I don't commit adultery. I'm not like this tax collector. I'm sure, Lord, he does all of those things, but me, you know me. I'm good. I'm a good man." So the Pharisee in his prayer time is spending time not in sorrow and repentance for sin, not in brokenness over what he's failed to do, but he has spent his prayer time in boasting. And that brings me back to what I was sharing with you, the illustration at the mosque. Muslims pray, but it's merit. It's points. It's like God is the great bookkeeper, keeping track. Well, Muslims teach they have, you know, an angel sitting on each shoulder, one that records our bad deeds and one that records our good deeds. And so Islam is very works-oriented, performance-oriented, obedience-oriented, and that gaining merit is the most important thing. And obviously, Jesus knows about this, and he understands the human heart, and he's trying to make a point also to us as Christians, I think, that we too need to be careful that we're not boasting at the end of the day in our own righteousness, in our own performance. You know, I hear many, many stories from my friends. Sometimes they'll share how they feel like sometimes they're on a performance treadmill. But all of us as Christians understand this one thing, and sometimes we forget it. And as a good author, Jerry Bridges, used to teach, that we need to preach the gospel to us, ourselves, every day. What he meant was to remind us of why we have a right relationship with God that is based solely on his grace, through faith in what Jesus did at the cross, and that righteousness is a gift from God that can never be earned. And Jerry Bridges wrote, "This is the great besetting sin, that sometimes we are trusting in anything else but the righteousness of God through Christ. It's easy to get distracted on our good days even, and the things that we've done. Let's say we've been obedient today more than usual. We've done good things, and somehow we slip into that pattern of thinking that I'm a pretty good person. My righteousness is pretty well." And we forget that it is a gift. Now, the corresponding balance. We are to do good works. The Christian life is a life of obedience and good works as a result of our salvation. Never the reverse. Never as a means to gain it. Or else we're just like the Pharisee here. Jesus made this illustration very strong to show us that when we come to God, we come in brokenness and sorrow over sin. And notice the tax collector wasn't cozying up to God. He's standing away at a distance. Well, does that mean we should fear God? What it does mean, I think, is a proper reverential respect. We never have a slavish fear of God anymore as a Christian. But there is a reverence and a respect for him as a holy God. And so the Pharisee understood this. And that's why he thought, well, I can mosey up to God because he knows how good I am. Well, but the tax collector understood even more so that he was a sinner. And he says he beat his breast. God be merciful to me. Even on our best days, that should be our constant prayer. God be merciful to me, for I am a sinner. And Jesus says, this tax collector went home justified, that is, declared righteous in God's eyes. His sorrow over sin, his understanding of his condition, his understanding of his place. Jesus says, if you want to be exalted in God's presence, humble yourself first. He will exalt you. The Pharisee was busy exalting himself, busy priding himself. This parable struck home to me when I read it for the first time in my Christian walk. I remember reading, this is one of the first things I read in the Bible. And I was amazed that as I went to church, and I was Catholic at the time, I kind of got the feeling that there were many, many people like this Pharisee, going through the religious motions and going through the profession of faith, but there's no substance there. And I went back to this parable and I thought, God, if I understand what you're saying, you want people to come to you and to have a broken heart over sin. I began to see that as a very, very young Christian. Well, this parable is very special to me, but I think it says something to all of us. I know I have many Muslim friends, but I want to speak to all of us about this very important parable. And I want to speak to you, especially if you're someone that's doing some searching. Yesterday in the bookstore when I was working, there was a young black girl that came with her friend. She says, you know, I'm looking for something. I'm searching. I want to know how to get close to God. Well, I spent some time talking with her and sharing with her some books. One of the books I recommended was The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren that really talks about our purpose, why God created us, why we're here, where we're going. And I really sensed that she was still searching. And I asked her, do you have a personal relationship with Christ? Well, you know, I hope so, I think. Well, I had an opportunity to share with her about knowing Christ. And, you know, most of the people that walk in the bookstore are Christians, and this girl kind of was searching. And so I recommended a couple books to her and sold a Bible to her, a New Believer's Bible, and certainly praying that she understands what the gospel is, because that's why Jesus told this parable. What is the gospel? The gospel is not something that we do. It's something that has been done for us by Jesus. It is good news. The gospel is God's declaration of our righteousness provided to us by what Jesus did at the cross. Righteousness is the issue. How do I have a right relationship with God? Not by my own works, but by trusting in someone who lived perfectly, never breaking God's law, never doing a wrong thing, never sinning, and then offered himself as a substitute for me who deserved to be there. All of us deserve to be hanging there on the cross, receiving God's judgment and wrath for sin. But Jesus paved the way. He became our righteousness, our substitute. He is the gospel. He is the good news that every Christian needs to know, that every seeker needs to know. Nabil was one of those seekers. He looked back on his Muslim life, and he saw how he was obedient. He had memorized the Quran. He was doing his best to live up to the standards, the five pillars. And yet, there was an emptiness, a profound emptiness in his life. You see, like the Pharisee, you have to have a sense of guilt. And unless you have that sense of guilt and shame for being a sinner, you cannot come to God and receive this free gift of righteousness. But the Pharisee had the wrong idea. He thought, my acceptance is my good works. What's so sad about this is there's many so-called Christians who will hear the words of Jesus on Judgment Day, I never knew you. Jesus says, many will come to me saying, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied your name? Have we not done all these good works in your name? You see, the emphasis and the focus is on the works of their hands instead of on what Jesus has done. So this parable should hit home to us. Don't be like the Pharisee in praying. Keep a humble heart. To the one who is seeking, and to the person who may be a Muslim or whatever, the way to have a right relationship with God is to come to him, admit we're a sinner, and trust in the free gift of salvation that God has provided through Christ. This amazing contrast is so important that we keep this in mind when we think about spirituality. There are many people today going to every kind of smorgasbord, New Age, Hinduism, Buddhism, every ism of the world, getting on the path for a true spirituality. And Jesus says to those that are looking for truth in all of the wrong places, he says to you and me and to the spiritual seeker, I am the way and the truth and the life. He invites us to come to him to find the way. It's him. To know the truth, it's him. To live abundantly, it's life in Jesus. Jesus solves all of the philosophical questions with that statement. All of the seekers after spirituality and philosophy looking for some purpose and meaning in life are always confronted by the words of Jesus. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. My seminary professor talked at length about spirituality. He had a heart for evangelism and reaching the lost. And one of the things he stressed in our class was that we never are shown to show disrespect to unbelievers. He would have failed us if we wrote an example of how we would talk to some non-Christian and we showed some disrespect. And that's where I learned this firsthand. My seminary professor drilled into me, for lack of a better word, the respect that we show non-Christians. And so I respectfully say to you, if you're looking for spirituality and truth, Jesus invites you to come to him. He invites you to ask any question you would have. He claims to be the way, so if you're lost, come to him. If you're looking for truth, whatever philosophy you're involved in, Jesus says, look, I am the truth. If you're looking for truth, come to me. And Jesus backs up his claims. He's not just a soothsayer, another sage making pronouncements. He backs it up in that he died and rose again. God vindicated the claims of Christ by raising him from the dead. You see, Jesus didn't make just claims. He himself rose up out of the tomb 3 days later to declare that he is Lord. He is Lord of heaven and earth, and that what he says is backed up by the fact that he died and rose again. showing the greatest love that the world has ever seen, in that he took our place and bore our shame and guilt. Muslims talk a lot about washing, preparing for prayer, shame and guilt. And I've got good news for you if you are a Muslim. And Jesus can provide you with the assurance through his love and forgiveness that one day you will go to paradise based on what he has done for you. His great love for you is a gift. Everyone needs to know this, that salvation is something that Jesus has done. And so as we conclude today, thinking about the Pharisee and the tax collector, here's the question I have for you. Which one are you? Are you the Pharisee boasting about your spirituality, boasting about your good works? You may be a person of prayer. Or are you like the publican or the tax collector, beating his breast saying, "Lord, be merciful to me, the sinner." And Jesus says, if you're like the Pharisee, you're lost. You have no conviction of sin. All of your praying will not get you into a right relationship with me. But if you're like the tax collector, that you bow in humility and confess your sin, I will come and forgive you and wash you clean completely from head to toe. This is a great parable about who Jesus is and what the gospel means. And this is the good news that I share with you today. Saeed is in prison in Iran, and he has shared powerfully this same good news with many, many Muslims. And last year, I remember Nagma talking, just last year in June, at a convocation at Liberty, how Saeed, through his witness, has shared his faith, and 35 Muslims in prison have trusted in Christ. Why? Because they're searching. Because they're empty. And they see the love of God in Saeed. They see something they desperately want. I hope and pray that today's parable from the Gospel of Luke has been eye-opening for you. It was for me initially as a new Christian. And I share this with you. I would just ask for you to continue to pray for Saeed and Amir Hikmati's release from Iran as we sit down at the table. Pray for our nation to have a conviction about what's going on in the world around them, that we do not give in to terrorists, that we see that human rights and not nuclear rights are the number one priority. I want to thank you, Vito and Mary and everyone in the chat room today for coming in. Thank you for being patient with the technical difficulties. We got the show today. I want to thank you for listening to The Cross in the Desert. It has been my pleasure to come with you for the last hour and a half. I want you to have an incredible week. God bless you. I will see you on the next Cross in the Desert this Thursday. God bless you. Have a great week.
Healing rain is coming down, it's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long. Hey.